From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A Florida state senator seems to have a leg up on the race to fill a vacated congressional seat, and although he has the nod from the incoming president, this individual insists he'll have enough time in the state legislature to get his priorities into law.
So none of these should come as a surprise to anyone. None of these are new positions. They're all things that I have done in the past.
Also this week, right before the holidays, Governor DeSantis and the Florida Cabinet approved the acquisition of more land to go under Florida Forever protections.
These lands are not going to be here forever. Many are not going to be here in 5 or 10 years.
We'll also explore ways to handle holiday stress and enjoy some tunes from a Broadway musical that became a smash movie hit. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report. Brevard Republican State Senator Randy Fine is running for Congress, and that means he'll leave the Florida legislature in the middle of this upcoming year's legislative session. But Tristan Wood reports that's not keeping Fine from filing controversial bills capturing the news cycle.
Fine is one of three Republicans who have entered the special election for former Congressman Matt Walz's seat, but he has President-elect Donald Trump's endorsement. If he wins that race, he will have to leave office in the middle of the legislative session. Representative Joel Rudman has already resigned from the Florida House ahead of his run for one of the other open congressional seats. So if he's hoping to switch jobs, why is Fine still working on legislation? He says he owes it to voters.
I work hard every day. I plan to run through the tape on every one of the 100-plus days that I remain in the state Senate. The voters elected me to do this, and I'm going to do it. There is plenty of time to pass these bills. I will be in the Senate for all 5 committee weeks and the first 4 weeks of session. So really 2/3 of the time available in the session to consider policy, I will be there.
The 3 bills Fine has filed so far are also not easy lifts. One would lower the gun purchasing age in Florida to 18. Another would rescind a program that allowed undocumented minors, often called Dreamers, to pay in-state tuition at Florida public universities. The third bill bans flags the legislation deems political, like LGBTQ Pride, Black Lives Matter, and Palestine flags, from being displayed in or on public buildings. All those bills are issues Fine has pushed as a representative in the House.
So none of these should come as a surprise to anyone. None of these are new positions. They're all things that I have done in the past.
And Fine says he plans on filing more measures. State representatives can only file 7 bills, while state senators don't have a limit. Since this is his first and likely last year as state senator, Fine wants to take advantage of that.
In the Senate, I could file 200 bills if I so chose. I'm not planning to, but I could if I wanted. So why would I not file every good policy idea that I know of and see what I can get across the finish line? Because there's no limit. It's a completely different paradigm than the House.
It's unclear what will happen to Fine's measures if he leaves office. Florida Senate President Ben Albritton says he's unsure what the process would look like.
We have to take a look at that and figure out how the process is going. I don't think it's usual. It's not business as usual. Okay. So we need to take a look at what the rules say.
Fine says he checked the rules, and as long as there is a co-sponsor to a bill, they can pick up the legislation as it makes its way through the legislature. Only one of the bills he filed currently has a co-sponsor.
If there's not another senator who wants to pick up and run with them, they weren't going to pass anyway. So I'm fairly optimistic, and I will be pushing hard to try to get them passed in the time that I have available.
Albritton also expressed uncertainty whether he would be willing to get behind Fine's bills. He says he needs to speak with the state's law enforcement agencies about lowering the gun buying age to form his perspective.
Most of you probably remember during my speech, measure 3 times, cut once. That applies here. So we're gonna be doing a lot of measuring on this to understand where we're going and what we're doing.
On removing the college funding for Dreamers, Albritton says he opposed it when it was first passed a decade ago, but now that it's in place, he would want a sunset provision added before removing it. The primary election for the open congressional seat takes place January 28th. The general election is April 1st, 2025. I'm Tristan Wood.
Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida cabinet have approved a huge tract of land acquisitions and conservation easements, including a new state park. We get more on that from Margie Menzel.
The land deals total $318 million and will help protect nearly 87,000 acres across the state. One purchase will create a new state park in Walton County that will double as a buffer for Eglin Air Force Base. The deals include $111 million from the Florida Forever Conservation Program for seven parcels.
These lands are not going to be here forever. Many are not going to be here in 5 or 10 years.
Florida Conservation Group Executive Director Julie Morris says the easements create protection for properties that provide green space, food, and wildlife corridors, along with clean air and water.
We have a short window of time to do this as development rapidly encroaches in these rural areas.
That's why, Morris says, funding was needed as soon as possible. And she's not the only one who feels that way. Audubon Florida Executive Director Julie Rathmel says the cabinet's work on Tuesday constitutes the largest increment of conservation land and easement purchases ever proposed on a single cabinet agenda.
They've gotten substantial appropriations in recent years, and they just recognize that we're losing Florida quickly and that, you know, the pace of protection has to match that.
Conservation easements allow farmers and ranchers to continue operations with the promise that their land won't be developed. The state pays property owners for the easements.
It's keeping working lands working, but it is removing the development rights from those properties. So in many ways, these easements serve to buffer, you know, the most vulnerable and the most sensitive natural areas that we would buy outright as a state.
Morris and Rathmel both praised Agriculture Commissioner Wilton Simpson, a farmer, for his role in bringing the land deals to fruition. Audubon's Rathmel says the deals have vast benefits.
These places protect not just wildlife, but also our quality of life, our property values, our water quality. They sequester carbon. They are underpinning our economy and our quality of life. And so it's money well spent, and I think a lot of Florida communities will be really excited about it.
Rathmel says the land deals protect 86,000 acres of Florida's most important wildlife habitats and rural ranch lands. I'm Margie Menzel.
Some slightly discouraging news on the Florida unemployment front. The state's unemployment rate ticked up to 3.4% in November after holding steady at 3.3% since April. That was according to a new report that was out today by the State Department of Commerce. The new rate reflects an estimated 376,000 Floridians qualifying as out of work in mid-November. That was 7,000 more than in October, out of a total labor force of just over 11 million people. The labor force was down by 14,000 folks from October and 46,000 from November of 2023. State economists attribute the reduction in the labor force to a rise in retirees. But a Florida Chamber Foundation report this year also cited what's called an out-migration from the state of a sizable number of people between the ages of 20 and 29. Coming up on Capitol Report, the incoming Trump administration and its threat of mass deportations of many immigrants has lots of people anxious. Although an expert in immigration law notes the issue has often changed over the years in response to who's in the White House.
Every time a president comes in, Republican or Democrat, no matter what, the enforcement priorities can change.
Forget the argument about whether or not America is a Christian nation. Is the country even a religious nation anymore? We'll check out some new data that shows there are few atheists in either foxholes or jail cells.
And it turns out atheists are dramatically underrepresented in prisons. We don't even say atheists are more moral, right? We're just like, there's no difference here.
And we'll discover that one of this year's monster film hits could have the unexpected bonus of getting more students involved in musical theater programs.
To have a career that is long-lasting, you need an intense training program like we have at Florida State, like there are all over the country.
The U.S. immigration court system has a backlog of more than 3 million pending cases. On average, immigration judges have about 4,500 cases on their dockets, but are only able to hear 15 to 20 cases a week. This bottleneck leads to significant delays in cases that can take years to resolve. WGCU's Mike Canary talked with retired Judge Denise Slavin, who served in South Florida's immigration court system for 24 years, about one reason why the system is so bogged down.
Can you explain how the immigration court system is not independent? It's not an Article III court. It actually falls under the executive branch. Can you just break that down for our listeners? Because I found that very enlightening.
It is a very unusual process because we talk about the court, but it's not a court in the conventional sense. So the articles of the Constitution, the first three articles talk about setting up a president, a Congress, and a judiciary. And the judiciary is Article III of the Constitution. And that's what we think of in terms of the standard federal courts is where they fall under the Constitution. But we, the immigration court, actually falls under the executive. It was court created by the executive to hear cases. When people first came over in Ellis, you know, on Ellis Island, there were no immigration courts. There were special inquiry officers at the in the Immigration Naturalization Service who reviewed case. And that has evolved over time. In the 70s, the immigration court system, late 70s, I think, was created to adjudicate cases. So it is, in that way, subject to a very political process because, you know, the boss of our agency, the president, is also the boss of all the law enforcement agencies. And as a result, every time a president comes in, Republican or Democrat, no matter what, the enforcement priorities can change. And that means the court's priorities change. So it's like you have a prosecutor in a criminal case saying, you know, well, we don't want you, Judge, this is how we want you to run your docket. I know that, you know, whatever your docket is now, we want you to take all your cases off your docket and we want you to hear all the shoplifting cases because that's our priority right now is shoplifting. Or Judge, we know you have a backlog, but we don't want you to address the backlog at all. We want you to hear last in, first out. So we want you to address all the new cases in, you know, 30 days and leave all the backlog sitting there while you do that. So it's strange to have a court that has the prosecution sort of telling the judges what to do. And so every administration has changed that, has had different priorities in terms of what types of cases they want us to do first.
Is that variability I'm assuming a part of the backlog? It's not just the demand from people who need to have cases heard, but it's also the way the system gets gummed up every 4 or 8 years.
Yeah, it basically politicization cripples efficiency and it kind of decimates due process. Judges are pressured to pursue short-term gains. And then as a result, you end up with costly appeals. Some of the procedural tools to manage our dockets and micromanagement sort of ignore judicial practice and docket management, well-established document management principles. For example, you know, I was talking about judges not spending time on cases that aren't ready to be heard yet. We've had various administrations come in and say, that's exactly the cases we want you to hear. And, you know, just go ahead and order them deported. We don't care. And then, you know, it'll go up through the appeals process and, you know, that's their problem. Well, then it goes up through the appeals process. The precedent changes, the priority changes. And then we, you know, end up having those same cases right back on our docket 2 years, 3 years later, 4 years later. Whereas cases we could have finished are bumped to the end of the line. Cases that everybody agrees are ready to say either yes or no, this person qualifies for this benefit that they are applying for.
That was retired immigration judge Denise Slavin talking with WGCU's Mike Canary about the immigration court system. Florida's new social media law limiting access for kids goes into effect next month. At the same time, TikTok could go on the chopping block for what federal officials say are national security concerns. Adrian Andrews spoke with a mental health expert about the pros and cons of social media and what life would look like without the apps.
When it comes to social media, Josette Sullins says it can be a positive for some and a driver of depression or anxiety for others.
All the interaction that's going on the social media is creating social comparison where, you know, if somebody can really feel bad about themselves or, you know, it's unrealistic social comparison. We also have clients that will come in that use social media for self-expression. Do you see what I mean? They're looking to try on new ideas, to find out things about themselves.
Sullins is a behavioral health expert who runs therapy care centers in Arizona and California. She says she's seen how social media negatively affects the mental well-being of some of her patients, sometimes causing low self-esteem, cyberbullying, and online addiction. But she says, as with many things, she thinks social media should be approached with balance.
We need to really be mindful and, you know, help our youth if we're going to allow them to use phones and social media, to have some guidelines and to know them ourselves.
Sullins also recommends taking a break from the apps and being sure to connect with the people around us. Researchers at the National Institutes of Health have linked excessive social media use to increased mental health concerns. Sullins says people who spend more than 2 hours a day on social media tend to suffer from depression and anxiety the most.
We can become anxious. And then some of the content, too, that is being exposed to also creates intense anxiety, you know, with the social comparison and the isolation and the bullying.
Florida's social media ban requires certain social media platforms with features labeled as addictive to permanently close online accounts held by minors 13 and younger, and requires 14 and 15-year-olds to get parental consent to keep or sign up for new accounts. Meanwhile, the federal government is calling for TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, to sell the platform because of concerns over its ties with the Chinese government. Florida's law takes effect January 1st. TikTok has until the 19th to sell or cease operations in the U.S. But will this make things better for folks struggling with mental health? Sullins says that answer isn't clear.
Time that the administration or regulation makes a drastic change, you know, in one way or the other, we are going to have extreme reactions, you know, from the public and also unforeseen consequences.
But Sullins says she supports efforts to protect the country's sensitive information, and she also believes legislation should be in place to help protect children from finding harmful material online. I'm Adrian Andrews.
The holiday season can be difficult for those who are grieving the loss of a loved one. Furry Friends can help people heal, as we hear from WLRN's Carlton Gillespie.
They say that if you enjoy your job, you'll never work a day in your life. And that's definitely true for Charlie, a 6-year-old golden retriever who is currently laying on her back getting belly rubs from a few children. For Charlie, this is work. She's a therapy dog at Canine Assisted Therapy in Oakland Park, where the formula for healing is simple. Just add dogs.
I think anyone who loves dogs knows how you feel when you walk into a room and you're greeted by a dog. All your stress level leaves you. Any inhibitions you have go out the door. You can just be yourself, your authentic self.
That's Monica Wislowski, the CEO.
You bring a dog into the equation and people feel better. It's the bottom line. It's that simple.
The organization has 140 dogs, all volunteers, that are certified to provide a range of therapeutic services. At this particular event, Charlie and her colleagues have teamed up for the first time with the Children's Bereavement Center. The center's CEO, Deborah Albo-Steger, said that this time of the year can be especially challenging for those who are grieving.
The holidays, while they are happy holidays for some, they are not happy holidays for everybody. People who've experienced a loss, especially in the last year, find the holidays very difficult.
The event, called Connect and Remember Together, had two goals: offer those struggling with grief an entryway into therapy, and offer those already in group sessions a chance to connect.
We call it grief light because sometimes it's very hard to say, I want to go to a support group. So when you come to an event like this with dogs or other organizations who it's a little bit lighter, they want to try it out and they're more likely to come to a group.
According to Wislowski, the dogs help people become more vulnerable.
Dogs do encourage people to open up. We've seen so many times where people are just upset and they're sitting quietly or by themselves, and then the dog comes in and they just open up, they let their emotions out, they talk more.
There was also music therapy led by Rebecca Rocant.
This is great for anger.
It allows people to express emotions through instruments.
When you have a revelation, you do the chime.
The event focused on forming connections for its participants also acted as a form of connection for its organizers. Both CBC and Canine Assisted Therapy hinted that this will be the first of many events. When asked for comment, Charlie just wagged her tail. I'm Carlton Gillespie in Oakland Park.
A growing number of people are identifying as religiously unaffiliated. The Pew Research Center says they make up more than 25% of the U.S. population. And this religious shift has ripple effects. WGCU's Elizabeth Andarji reports.
The rise of religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, has been trending over the past several years. University of Tampa sociology professor Ryan Cragen has uncovered surprising research about why people are leaving organized religion.
That massive rise of the non-religious is largely because people were already not particularly religious, but they were hiding it during the Cold War. And with the end of the Cold War, now you can be open about your non-religion and people aren't going to assume that you're not loyal.
During the 1950s, the U.S. wanted to distinguish itself from an atheist Soviet Union by emphasizing American religious values. This included adding "In God We Trust" to currency and mandating "One Nation Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. Politics aside, morality plays a huge role in this conversation. Or does it? Cragen argues that there are several misconceptions about the nuns' beliefs.
If we can conclude that criminality is a manifestation of morality, then we should be able to look at the religious affiliations of prison inmates and get a pretty good sense of whether non-religious people are less moral than religious people. And it turns out atheists are dramatically underrepresented in prisons. We don't even say atheists are more moral, right? We're just like, there's no difference here.
This begs the question, are there any differences between religious and non-religious groups?
Nothing pops out in the data. With one exception, there is one difference that is actually a genuine difference. Non-religious people have fewer kids. That's it.
Cragen shares how the church is grappling with this mass exodus.
Thousands of churches are closing down every year in the U.S. That's despite the fact that our U.S. population is growing. There's just not enough demand. So churches are shutting down.
As fewer people attend church, the rising question for religious leaders will be how to adapt to a society where the concept of belief in community may become none of what it used to be. I'm Elizabeth Andarji.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the big shots at MGM Studios were hoping their 1939 blockbuster movie, The Wizard of Oz, would be a long-running smash. But even they couldn't have imagined that flick is still generating spinoffs 85 years later. The new film Wicked is already one of the country's highest grossing movies this year, and it's also an international hit. The movie musical was adapted from the Broadway musical of the same name. Lauren Houghton Gillis thinks the success of the film could boost applications to music theater programs like the one she directs at Florida State University. Gillis appeared on Broadway and in a national tour of Wicked as a swing, a performer who fills in for ensemble cast members, and she spoke with Gina Jordan.
I was able to cover 10 roles, so at any time, if there was injury, vacation, sickness, I was, you know, called in to be one of 10 people in the show at a moment's notice. And sometimes I'd had hours of notice, and sometimes it would be like 5 minutes before curtain. And so it was an amazing, I feel like I got my first master's at Wicked because, of course, I had trained my whole life to sing, act, and dance, but it's a different thing to be able to jump up and do a show as and many different voice parts, many different dance parts. You know, I just had to be really malleable. And I learned a lot about myself, about performance, and it was an incredible job. I'm so thankful for that opportunity.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's exciting. So how do you think the success of a musical like Wicked at the Movies, you know, this is based on this Broadway show, how might this boost music theater programs like the one at FSU?
Well, we're in an interesting time in 2024. The Wicked movie was incredible, I do have to say. A lot of people are asking my opinion because I was just a part of the theatrical experience for so long. But I think the talent is just getting more advanced every day. Mm-hmm. I look at students, when we're recruiting and when we're looking at auditions for the program, I can't believe the talent I'm seeing. And yes, you can go right to New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, and you can pursue this right out of high school, 17, 18. But to have a career that is long-lasting, you need an intense training program like we have at Florida State, like there are all over the country. You know, to learn how to do 8 shows in 1 week, to maintain your voice and to, you know, maintain your body as a dancer, not only as a dancer, but to be on stage and to do something over and over again, you have to train and you have to know what that takes and to know how to keep yourself healthy.
Yeah.
I know so many people who have success young and then they burn out. So a program like Florida State, a program like so many of my colleagues have all over the country, really gets you ready for the rigor of this career.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people that were my friends that were performing on Broadway 10 years ago are now running programs because they want to give back. They want to help the next generation and usher them into this amazing art form of musical theater. So I believe that it's completely wholeheartedly necessary to go to a program like this. And so I do think that the movie is going to create a lot of hopes and dreams, of Broadway dreams or maybe like, you know, Hollywood dreams for a lot of young people. And therefore, I think that's going to translate to a lot more people wanting to pursue musical theater, which is very, very exciting.
Yeah. I also wonder if this movie will translate into a lot of people wanting to go to the theater, to go see live theater. I mean, you would think it would.
I am very hopeful. You know, I think often about, wow, what incredible things are happening with film and TV. And I can stream so much just in the luxury of my living room. I have 2 children, so I have a big Elsa fan at home. but nothing replaces the idea and the experience of going to a show with live piano, live orchestra. You know, nothing will ever, ever replicate that.
That was FSU Music Theater Assistant Professor Lauren Houghton Gillis speaking with Gina Jordan. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Mike Canary, Carlton Gillespie, and Elizabeth Andarji. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. All of us who produce Capitol Report throughout the year hope your holidays are happy and fulfilling. Next week, we'll bring you a special show featuring some of the best work of our reporting team from 2024. And for the first program of the new year, we'll revisit and update some of the top stories from the old year. Thanks so much for listening, and we invite you to join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.